Hello and welcome to episode 409 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We are the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous. You can share news or ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. We got a free class coming up. I hope everybody will join. It is taught by Ben Olson. He's teaching a reading comprehension class on Monday, July 10th. That's 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Go to lsat.link/Ben if you would like to sign up for Ben's free reading comprehension class. Again, Monday, July 10th, 10 Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, lsat.link/Ben.
Yeah, so when you come to that class, what you're going to hear, what we're going to do is we're going to do a reading comp passage, and then I'm going to read that passage to you after you have attempted to do it yourself, and you're going to learn how to engage with a passage sentence by sentence, right? This is the biggest mistake that people make, is they rush through these passages or they read for structure or whatever the hell they're trying to do to master the reading comp section. But I'm going to show you how to read a passage sentence by sentence and engage and react with that sentence as you go, and show you how to make predictions about where you think the author is going. And you can then see how those predictions are either right or wrong, but that doesn't matter. It's not about making the right predictions. It's about making predictions so that when you get to whatever is actually happening in the passage, you are much, much more aware of what the author is trying to say. And then that helps you identify the main point, which then helps you answer really all of the questions.
It's free. All you need is a free LSAT Demon account. Go to lsat.link/Ben to sign up. You're going to see Ben exert his dominance over a reading comprehension passage. And I think that's really a kind of a good way of thinking about it, right? You do have to like just destroy. You got to be on top of these documents. I mean, think about what's going to happen in a legal context. That document is going to be relevant to some legal matter. And you're going to, you know, you're not going to have it memorized. But if you're prepared, you're gonna know what's in that document. I mean, you're gonna know what evidence is there. You're gonna know what conclusions they're reaching. You're gonna have actively, thoroughly read every single sentence, like not just some of it, not just kind of scraping out keywords and general concepts. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm gonna do enough to write a book report and make it clear that I read it. Rather, it's like, no, they're going to ask you pointed questions about what's in that document. So you need to have read it closely enough that you feel really comfortable going like, yeah, I got it. I read the document closely. Like I could tell you basically why this document exists. It's just a slightly different kind, or well, significantly different kind of reading than what people are probably used to, especially if they're straight out of undergrad.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, can you imagine an attorney going to a court or talking to a partner if you're like a younger associate and not knowing more about the documents or the cases than, say, the opponent or the judge? I mean, you are going in there and you're going to convince them of your perspective on the issue. How do you do that? You have to know everything about what you've read, as well as their likely objections. You know more than them.
Yeah,
and that's how you can approach reading comp. You literally know more than the test writers. You're like, no. Right. I know what the fuck was said here, and I can go in and I can answer any question about it.
Right.
And I can also tell you why there might be some other questions you could ask.
Yeah. If lawyers are gladiators that you hire to fight in English on your behalf, well, these documents are kind of like the map of the battlefield, maybe. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's like, you better know what, like, what are we going to be discussing here? Like, what are we going to be fighting about? What's the terrain, or what are the weapons that are available, or what's the, you know, like, where are the advantages to be gained? And you really do need to, again, not memorize the document, but you've got to be the boss of that document.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to lose in that legal battle. All right. Now we have this email from Hibba, maybe. Why don't you go ahead and read it?
Hi. Not so much a question, but a wording I found extremely helpful to me in terms of eliminating the whole contrapositive confusion. Okay. Now here's the wording. Thinking of the necessary condition as a prerequisite for the sufficient condition to be able to take place.
Yeah, I mean, that's another definition of what a necessary condition is. The problem is, you know, it's using the terms necessary condition and sufficient condition in its own definition, which, like, you have to understand what the sufficient condition means in order for that to really make sense. Like, prerequisite is another. I guess it's not, though, really a prerequisite, is it?
Yeah, there's a slight problem there. I mean, it could be that the necessary condition has to take place before the sufficient condition takes place. But
okay,
doesn't in have to.
This example, yeah. If I chop your head off, you will die.
Yeah.
Dying is the necessary condition, but that's not a prerequisite.
Yeah, I don't have to be dead for you to cut off head.
It's a post-requisite. Yeah. You know what the right word is? Probably requisite.
Just requisite.
Right. It's a thing that is required. So whether it's a prerequisite or a post-requisite is irrelevant. It is a requisite, I think, would be the correction there. Is that a word? I think it is.
I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I would just drop
requisite.
Let's deepen
our knowledge of the English language. Requisite is an adjective that means made necessary by particular circumstances or regulations, or it's a noun. And I think here we're more interested in it as a noun. A thing that is necessary for the achievement of a specified end.
So requisite just means required, which just means necessary. So what this person is saying is that the necessary condition is necessary for the sufficient condition, which is true.
True. Okay. Do we want to read the rest of this?
I mean, this was helpful for Hiba, and that's great, Hiba. I think this is something that people need to grapple with. They need to not just hear the phrase necessary condition, but they need to hear it and then feel it, right? Like, oh, necessary condition, that must be a condition or an event or something that is necessary. And then you're really getting your mind wrapped around it. And what does sufficient mean? It means it's enough. So if that happens, you know that the other thing has to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe Hiba's thing is worth reading through. Why don't you just do it quickly? I'll try to show.
Sure. Okay. If the necessary condition has not been met, then it is impossible for the sufficient condition to also take place because its prerequisite hasn't been fulfilled. Yeah.
Just important necessary- to note that doesn't have to happen like temporally. Because again, in my example, if I chop off your head, you're going to die. You don't have to die first in order for me to chop off your head. It's just like, if you're not going to die, then I can't chop off your head.
Exactly. And it could take minutes, right? Like maybe I run around with my head chopped off like chicken.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it doesn't have to happen in that moment. I mean, it certainly can happen afterward is all I'm saying. So
yep.
Prerequisite it like you have to take the, you know, algebra one before you can take algebra two. Algebra one is a prerequisite for taking algebra two. But that's not really how it works in necessary and sufficient terms, because you can absolutely do the requisite after, like the sufficient condition can happen and then the necessary condition can happen after that.
Yeah. I not to get too morbid, but maybe another example that would really help hit this home is like cancer, right? Like if you get exposed to radiation, you may not die for years and years and years, but it could still be a necessary condition depending on the level of radiation you were exposed to. Anyways, she continues, but if the necessary condition has been met, all that means is that the sufficient condition becomes a possibility now.
Yeah. So if you die, like if I know you're going to die, let's say Ben Olson is going to die today. That is June 27th of 2023. Ben, it's been a pleasure. Nice knowing you.
Yeah. Likewise. Thanks, man.
Ben's going out today. Yep. Okay. So if we know that that's a fact, that Ben is going to die today, then it does make it possible that I'm going to get in a car or I'm going to go fly to DC. I'm going to go to Ben's house and I'm going to put him to the guillotine.
I mean, it is
possible that I will cut off Ben's head today if we know that Ben is going to die today.
If you're new to the show, not all episodes have this
50 to 60% focused on this. Okay.
Yeah. So it's possible, but that's a key word there because it's definitely not guaranteed, right? Like I could die for a whole host of other reasons.
Wood chipper accident.
Yeah. Or just, you know, extraordinary sense of gratitude just overwhelms me.
Wow. That's nice. Yeah. Okay. Want to continue with Hibba's note here?
Yeah. Yeah. In reverse, if the sufficient condition is met, we know that the necessary condition must have been two by that logic, although it's not causal. Fair enough. Yep. I mean, that may be a little distraction for some people, but the point is if the sufficient condition is met, then we know the necessary condition is going to have to be met too. If the sufficient condition is not met, it doesn't tell us anything about whether its prerequisite, the necessary condition, is or is not met.
Right. 100%. So in my, again, continuing my example, if it is known that I did not chop off Ben's head today, if we know that Ben, like if we know that Ben makes it to midnight on June 27th with his head attached, does that mean that Ben didn't die today?
Says nothing, right? I could die.
Ben could die.
Car accident or whatever.
I could come up with so many different ways that Ben could die today.
Yeah, let's just keep doing that.
Sausage grinder accident. You know, airplane crashes into your house. Lots of things could happen.
Yes, but
weightlifting accident.
All these things could still result in my death, even though you have not done the sufficient condition, which is cutting off my head. At the same time, it is a sufficient condition, because if you do cut off my head, my death or my demise is
guaranteed.
And that's what makes it a, quote, sufficient condition.
Enough.
It's enough. We know that if that happens, we don't need to know anything else about the universe. I'm a goner. So
sufficient means enough. Necessary means has to happen.
Yep.
It's like, and it is true that it's not causal necessarily. Like, sufficient conditions don't have to be causal.
No, they don't. That's right. In our example, it happens to be causal, but it doesn't have to be. All we know is that if one thing happens, this other thing is going to happen. Okay.
Right.
Cool. Thanks for writing in. I hope that helped other people. Looks like we have a test question here.
Sure. I think we could probably do this quickly. So see how this works out in real life. This is test 65, section 1, question number 24. An editorial says, one of our local television stations has been criticized for its recent coverage of the personal problems of a local politician's nephew. But the coverage was, in fact, good journalism. Any reaction to that first sentence?
Yeah, for sure. So the last part of that first sentence, but the coverage was in fact good journalism, sounds like a conclusion to me. I mean, I could be wrong, but the editorial is coming out and saying, oh, this was good. So I mean, and some other people have already criticized it saying it was bad. So, okay, there seems like the debate. Now I'm waiting for the editorial to tell me why he or she thinks the coverage was in fact good.
The information was accurate.
Okay, that's helpful. I would consider that a point in the coverage was good, but it doesn't prove it, but it's
right, because your job is kind of to object, right? So what's the objection?
Oh, it could be accurate, but not newsworthy. Not, it could just be, you know, airing someone's dirty laundry for no reason.
Right there is the game. That's the game, right? Yeah. We know you're trying to prove that this coverage was good journalism. We know that you're using this item, the information was accurate. You're using that as evidence for your conclusion that the coverage was, in fact, good. Our job is to grant you your evidence but disagree with your conclusion. So we say, even though the information was accurate.
Or true. Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's good journalism.
Yep.
Why? Like, it doesn't necessarily mean it was good journalism. Why? Well, yeah, like as Ben said, hey, what if covering this topic, like just because it's factual, doesn't mean that you should cover it?
Yeah.
Okay. Furthermore, the newscast had significantly more viewers than it normally does. I see Ben grimacing. Good. What's going on in your mind there?
Well, just because it's very popular or very interesting to a lot of people still doesn't mean that it's newsworthy. It could just be this, what is it? It's like this morbid obsession with someone's personal problems, right? It's like, haha, look at that person. They can't handle themselves in some way. And of course, a lot of people are interested, but does that mean that we should be talking about it or writing articles about it?
Yeah. And then it kind of just, it doesn't really add much more because many people are curious about the politician's nephew's problems.
Okay. Again, should they be curious about that? I don't know. Argument fails. I mean, it does provide some evidence.
Sorry for a gross example, but like, what are we really talking about here, right? This is, what if it's skid marks in the politician's nephew's underwear?
Okay.
Like, it's a fact. It's a fact. The politician's nephew has skid marks on his underwear. We did it in expose, you know, Geraldo Rivera, like breaking into the dude's laundry hamper and pulling out the underwear to display the skid marks. Oh, but listen, it is a fact. It was accurate. And hey, this newscast had significantly more viewers than it normally does because people are curious about this person's problems.
Yeah.
And your objection is?
Oh, just not newsworthy, right? Not something for public consumption.
Right. It can be factual. People can be interested in it. That does not necessarily mean it's good journalism. It doesn't mean it's not good journalism. In fact, it's probably points in favor of it being good journalism. But you're able to say, you're able to just separate that to go like, yeah, you've got some evidence.
Yeah.
But your evidence does not, even if it's true, does not prove your conclusion.
Which is interesting. That kind of goes back to what we were just talking about. It wasn't sufficient. The evidence wasn't enough to guarantee
it's not
the conclusion.
Enough.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Let's do the question. Which one of the following principles, if valid, would most help to justify the reasoning in the editorial?
Okay, so I'm looking to strengthen this argument. So we have some evidence. I want more evidence. I want something that says, hey, if your information is accurate, and it happens to be something that a lot of people are interested in, then, that's good enough. We now know it's good journalism. I'd love to see an answer like that.
Great. A, journalism deserves to be criticized if it does not provide information that people want.
Okay, that's not a situation that we're talking about right now. We're talking about a situation in which people are curious about this information. So this is an answer telling me about a situation that is not applicable here.
Yeah, we want if they are curious.
Yep.
It is good journalism. B, any journalism that intentionally misrepresents the facts of a case.
We can stop because we're not talking about that kind of journalism. It's not intentionally misrepresenting
that
the facts.
Didn't happen in this case. The facts were accurate. C, any journalism that provides accurate information on a subject about which there is considerable interest is good journalism.
Okay, that was my prediction. And it basically says if these two things are true, then it's good journalism. And those two things, based on the evidence, are true. So now the argument's actually essentially proven.
When you start doing it our way, you will be predicting these answers. Like frequently, you'll read the argument. And before you even read the question, you will predict the answer.
Yeah.
Because
not always.
It's like,
right. Sometimes you read the argument and you make a sense. You get a sense of how bad the argument is. And then you read the question and then you have a very good prediction. But yeah, you can before.
Well, you know what
the
battlefield is, right? Like going back to my, you know, in reading comp, the passage is the battlefield, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is what we're going to be fighting about.
Yeah.
And so here it's kind of the same thing in miniature. Like this argument is the battlefield. And you read that and you go, well, I don't know. Like, I haven't read the question yet. And you go, I don't know whose team I'm on here. But just because people are interested in it, just because the information is accurate, that does not mean that it's good journalism. And then if they go, yeah, but you're on that team, which that's what the question does here, is it just tells you whose team you're on. You know, how do you help this argument? Oh, shit. Well, if I'm trying to prove this, then I need something that builds a bridge between facts or people are curious. Two, therefore, it's good journalism. And you know that going in. And, you know, if you're on the other team, right, if it's a weakened question, you're going to be saying the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Are you on the defense team or are you on the prosecution, right? Like,
very frequently, that's all the question does, right? This is an example of why it's so useless to read the question first. Because reading the question first, it's like, oh, it's strengthen or versus, oh, it's weaken. Well, yeah, okay. But, like, we have a fucking map of the battlefield. Yeah. We don't need to know what team we're on yet. Let's start studying the map of the battlefield. Then we'll figure out like where we want to go.
Yeah. In fact, imagine, again, I just want to help people to see how this relates to the practice of law. If you're an attorney for the opposing side, you can easily switch sides and make all the opposing arguments. In fact, the best attorneys, if they switch sides, would be able to do that very almost better than the attorneys that are on the other side.
Yeah, I don't think almost better. Yeah. Like, why do debate teams practice arguing both sides of a debate?
You have to understand the other side to take it down.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can't write their argument for them, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
D, good journalism will always provide people with information that they desire or need.
Okay. So this is telling me that good journalism has this characteristic. It provides people with information that they want. I know that in this case, people are getting information that they want, but does that then make it good journalism? This is confusing, sufficient for necessary.
Yeah, it's like saying NBA players are tall. John's tall, so John's going to be a good NBA player. And it's like, Well, you know, I mean, that's a point in his favor, I suppose. But it's not, it's just not enough. Where, you know, C proves the conclusion of the argument. Do you think D is a strengthener at all? Like, it seems like a just kind of a real weak strengthener.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it certainly does not hurt. Right. Because we know that this has information that people are curious about, but it doesn't help that much.
I read it as the kind of thing that you might want to put in the brief. It's like it seems like it helps, but it certainly does not help as much as C does. Right. C proves your case.
Yep.
And D's like, well, it mildly somewhat helps. I want to point out here that this is not really a very, you know, it's not like C is slightly better than D.
No. C is astronomically better.
C is dispositive, right? It ends the battle.
TKO? Is that the right phrase?
It's kind of like, well, it could be a TKO. It could be just a straight up KO, right? I mean,
wait, KO, what's the difference? I thought a total knockout would be.
No. TKO stands for technical knockout. Okay, so well, like if you knock your opponent down three times.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a TKO.
Okay.
Or it, depending on the rules, but like, yeah, if you're on the mat three times, then it's like a technical knockout, but a knockout is like count out, you know, like you're not getting up. That's a knockout. Yes.
And that's what C is. C is a KO and D is like, hey, do you want a sip of water to help you keep fighting? Like
like you blocked one jab from the opponent. Great. Okay, cool. That helps you, but not like C does. C, the guy is like unconscious. Okay.
Yeah.
E, journalism that neither satisfies the public's curiosity nor provides accurate information can never be considered good journalism. This is the answer I think that people probably struggle with the most if they struggle with this question, but go ahead.
Yeah. So this is like, if you don't have the two characteristics that we mentioned, then you're not good, but we have them. So this is, again, this is not a situation that we're talking about. So,
right. Like go back to my NBA example.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if you're 4 feet tall, you cannot play in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and again, right, in my example, the player, you know, this guy is tall.
Yeah.
So therefore, he's going to play in the NBA. Because if you're short, you can't play in the NBA.
Yeah.
So this tall guy clearly is going to play in the NBA.
Yep.
What?
Yeah. I'm glad Eric provided this example because here, right, in answer choice E, we've seen it actually multiple times throughout here, but this is saying, hey, to be good journalism, here are two necessary conditions. You have to satisfy curiosity and you have to provide accurate information. Okay, they're necessary conditions. Does that mean that if you do them, you're now good to go? No. And that's exactly what Hibba was saying.
Yeah, like just like, if Ben's head remains attached to his body for the remainder of June 27th, that's a very mild point in his favor of he's going to live through June 27th. You know, does not in any way prove that Ben doesn't drop dead today.
Yeah, it's a necessary condition. I need my head to live, but it doesn't guarantee anything. Yeah.
Yeah. odds are pretty good that your head is going to be attached to your body on the day that you in fact die.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I think that's good. Want to move along?
Let's do it.
All right. This is an email from Henry. The subject is only completing half of the LSAT / LSAT progression.
Okay. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I've started studying for the LSAT and committed to studying for however long it takes. I've been listening to the podcast for a while now, even before taking the diagnostic test. I tried employing the strategy of answering every question correctly and just guessing on the rest.
Good.
Cool. However, I was rushing through the questions to cover more ground.
Well, then you weren't doing the thing that you just said you were doing. But that's not like I'm not mocking Henry, right? This is a battle for a lot of students. It's a really hard thing for people to actually adopt. I mean, like there are people who are acolytes of us, right? I mean, like we have demon cultists among our students who claim to be like just fully on board, right? It's like the student who is sitting there in the demon hoodie while they're doing it. And they're like, I'm really focusing on accuracy. And then it's like in their timed sections, they're doing the whole section and missing 10 questions.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but you still have not yet actually, like you're not actually doing it.
Well, this is just life too, right? Like there's so many ideas that come to me.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. And then it's like a week later, I'm doing half. Like Henry's saying here, I'm doing half of what I just aspired to do, or maybe even less. And to be fair to Henry, I just realized I overread his previous sentence. He said, I tried employing.
Yeah.
So he acknowledges right there that it didn't happen, right? Anyways, he continues, my cold diagnostic score was 152.
Sweet.
Shit, man. Good work.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yes. My goal is to consistently score in the 170s before the actual test.
That's not a but, Henry. That's an and.
Yeah.
That's not a but. 152. Like when you say 152 cold diagnostic, I go a student who, if they do the right things, will inevitably end up in the 170s. I'm not shitting you. I swear to God,
inevitably is a strong word there.
What's that?
Inevitably?
Hey, okay. Inevitably, not that I'm guaranteeing it 100%, but I would make some wagers. Like anybody want to bet me?
Yeah.
I'll bet you that Henry makes it into the 170s if he does what I want him to do.
You think it's so close to inevitable that you're willing to bet?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So, right. Inevitable is not the right word, but I will say it is more likely than not.
For sure. Yeah. I agree with you on that one. Especially with your conditions, right?
That's fucking wild to think about, by the way. Yeah. I never would have said that even 5 years ago. I never would have said if you start at 152, I'm confident you're going to make it into the 170s.
Yeah. I would be happy for them. I would be excited for them.
And I wouldn't be super surprised if they did, but I never would have said, and I think it's just because of the demon. I never would, or maybe it's because of teaching live classes online now, which is wildly more efficient than trying to teach live classes in person. Like demon students come to us with a cold diagnostic of 152. We go, sweet. We're going to get you into the 170s. I feel pretty solid about that. If you do the things we're asking you to do, 170s are going to be happening. Okay, go ahead.
Cool. Currently, when I do time sections, I only manage to complete about half the test. I understand that there may be variations in individual progress, but I wanted to know if it's normal for someone to only complete half the test while using these strategies. My approach is to slowly improve, aiming to get the first 20 questions in each section correct, and gradually progress from there. I'm curious if other LSAT Demon students have experienced similar progression. Thank you for everything you do. Kindly, Henry.
Yeah, you're probably 20 questions is too much for you right now, Henry. You need to be focusing on the first 5 questions in the section, and then the first 10 questions in the section, and then the first 15 questions in the section. If you can get the first 15 right and guess on the rest, you're probably already in the 150s. The first 20, like you would be solidly in the 160s, I think. And so it's like, I get what you're saying, Henry, but like, there's nothing magic about 20. It's just what you really need to be thinking is the one in front of you right now.
Yep.
Like, I don't like it when students set goals for how many questions they're going to do in the section. Like, don't set a goal for how many games you're going to do. Don't set a goal for how many reading comp passages you're going to do. Don't set a goal for how many LR questions you're going to do. Instead, get this one right.
Yeah. That's why we have the accuracy measure in time sections in the Daemon, right? When you finish a section, you can look at how many you got correct out of the ones you attempted, not out of the entire section.
Right.
Well, you get both of those numbers, but you can focus on accuracy.
But accuracy on questions attempted is what's important. I don't care how many questions you attempted. I care how accurate you were on the questions attempted. Because if you can keep it like, okay, I'm at 95% accuracy on my questions attempted, then you are also going to be over time reaching more and more questions because you're actually solving them. The test is going to just reveal itself to you. You're realizing that each of these questions is just solvable, right? It's like on its face, you can read it carefully enough and just go, I guess maybe on its face is not the right way to say that, but the evidence is there. Like it's a puzzle that will unlock itself. It's all right there. You just have to kind of tinker with it. Maybe it doesn't unlock itself.
You unlock it.
You unlock it. But it gives you all the information that you need. You know, it's just like it's solvable. So focus on high accuracy. You start to see how solvable the test is. And once you realize how solvable the test is, then you go faster and faster effortlessly. You should never be trying to reach more questions. You should always be trying to unlock one question. Okay.
Hey, you know, I want to say something that you said earlier. You said the struggle is real or something like that, right? Like people are all in with the idea of focusing on accuracy, but they
can't do
fail
it
to meet that ideal, right?
Yeah.
And it just yesterday I was working out and I have notes exactly how I want to do each rep. Cause there's like form, right? And
yep.
It's very easy for that form to start slipping.
Yep.
And then the progress that you're making it's an illusion, right? And my form slipped on the last two reps. And there's part of me that just wants to clock. I did 11 reps.
Yeah, yeah.
But in my head, I'm like, no, cause the form was bad on those last two. Yep. So I actually did 9. So I edited it and I changed it back to 9.
Yep.
But why am I doing that? Because in the long run, that good form, forcing myself to stick with it or otherwise not get credit for it, is what's going to help me get stronger and continue to push those numbers up. And they have gone up over time.
Yep.
Right. But the struggle is real. Cause it's like, there's this huge, immense temptation to just be like, yeah, I did it. I actually did it. I did those reps. But no, I didn't.
No,
I didn't do them to my standard. And that's the same for these questions. If you get them wrong, you're not making progress.
Yep.
Anyways.
I think that's good. I think we covered it. Thank you, Henry, for writing in. Just please stay focused on accuracy. The battle is really just one question at a time. If you can be patient, be like Ben, strive for good form, you'll be an Adonis like Ben over time. Next email here, a fund manager says, quote, do not go to law school. This is from Yahoo Finance. There's a couple highlights from this article. We'll link to this in the show notes. What do you want to say about this article?
Well, first of all, my dad sent it to me. So thanks, Dad. Okay. Not that he's ever going to listen to this, but we've talked about this before, but we have this fund manager who works with a lot of companies, right? And a lot of companies hire attorneys to do contract work. And he was just commenting about how several of them are turning to ChatGPT for complex contracts because it saves them thousands of dollars. Are those contracts going to be great? No. But the mere fact that they do it on some occasion just shows, right, where this can be going. Here's a couple quotes from the article. Oh, the article went on. This is so the fund manager was talking about his personal experience seeing business people using ChatGPT instead of attorneys for some things. But the article went on and said the careers of highly educated professionals were found to be more exposed to automation tools than blue collar workers with trade skills, according to one study recently conducted by ChatGPT creator OpenAI. Okay. The legal profession has exposure levels as high as 76%. What's worse, legal secretaries and administrative assistants could find themselves 100% exposed since AI could do these tasks relatively easily. The legal profession is dominated by words, and this tool is designed to put together words.
Yeah, and there's lots of law that is sort of like filling out forms, you know, checking boxes. Yeah. Somebody is going to need to be there to guide the AI, but sure. It's going to make the best attorneys wildly more efficient.
Which then requires fewer attorneys.
There are going to be far fewer paper pushing types of attorneys where it's like you don't really do anything, like your brain is not really that engaged. It seems like it's going to be very helpful for things like doc review. Thank God it's going to get rid of a lot of like really menial, tedious legal tasks, including stuff that, yeah, legal secretaries and administrative assistants do. Okay, that's really interesting. The rest of the article had a bunch of bullshit in it, didn't it? It had some, like, you got to be real skeptical of everything you read. One of the things that was particularly laughable was like late in the thing, because it's talking about, well, one, it's giving people advice to like, well, don't go into law, instead become a plumber, which is like, well, okay, if you like that kind of work and if you know, like plumbers can make good livings. And I suppose if you want to work for somebody else and be a plumber, you know, you can probably get to a life where you're going to make six figures as a plumber.
Yeah.
But you're probably never going to make seven figures as a plumber unless you like start your own business and right. Like, yeah. there is limited upside in these trades. There might be like safe, you know, like probably not a lot of downside. I mean, like thinking of a world where we don't need plumbers anymore is like, right. That ain't happening.
Yeah.
But it's also, you're kind of like limiting, you know, the upside of your achievement. But then like later, so like you have to decide whether you want to do a trade or whether you want to try to be a white collar worker. Later, it said something completely ridiculous when it was like, it said that truck drivers are not exposed to AI.
Yeah. Not to ChatGPT, sure. But how about just automated driving? I think that's where the money is. In fact, that's why Tesla and these other companies are focusing on trucks.
Like, right? I know a guy, I play golf with a guy who is an engineer who works on the Tesla Semi. And he was like telling me about how the semis are doing out in the field. You know, they're like in the world now. They're automated trucks driving around for Pepsi.
Wow. And they have a driver with them, I guess, or no?
Maybe. Or, I don't. Yeah, probably. Yeah. But like the thing is that that's a real thing and it's like out there in the world. And you don't think that they're exposed? That's a very menial, right? You're like sitting there doing nothing for hundreds of miles. That's probably going to be replaced by a robot.
Yep.
Okay. Anyway, let's move along. Cassandra says 3.0 for top 14 ? You know, I read that and I immediately go, yeah, probably not.
Probably not.
Like, just, I mean, look at the numbers. It's just very unlikely. Probably every school in the top 14 admits at least one person with a 3.0 every single year. That wouldn't surprise me at all if that were true.
Yeah.
Could be false as well. Could be that they don't. But they admit outliers. You know, they're going to make special accommodations for special candidates.
Yep.
Okay. Here's the email. Hi. When I began college in 2006, okay, so a while ago, I was pre-med. Being super lost and not knowing anything about life, I spent semester after semester failing science courses. You know, this is so common. Did you have buddies in college who did this?
Yeah, I mean, they're just like, well, I went to college and I foolishly thought that it was like high school. So I literally signed up for chemistry, physics, history, like what math, whatever the next math was. I didn't know what I was doing.
I mean, that is awesome if you're also a good student and like do all the work and get good grades. That's fantastic.
Well, I figured out what my problem was when I went to the math department. I said, hey, what's the next semester? I was like, what's the next class I need to take? And the girl was like, wait, are you majoring in math? And I'm like, what? No, I just did this linear algebra class. What's next? What's next in the,
yeah.
What's the next level of math? And she's like, I don't think you understand. Are you pursuing a math degree? Or are you doing something else? I was like, oh, and that's when it dawned on me that I needed to pick like a area and focus on it.
A major and like,
yeah.
Do the things that are required to graduate with that.
I mean,
major.
That was a tangent and I'm sorry for that, but it's like, yes. I knew people who didn't know what they were doing and they took hard engineering classes because they thought that would be the shit. People just don't know what they're doing when they go into law school.
I went to UC Davis in 1994. Shout out Gilmore 5 dorm hall. But anyway, I swear to God, like half of those people were pre-med who were failing physics, chemistry, bio. Not all of them out, you know, the hard calculus, they were taking all these pre-med classes and they were struggling and they were learning in their first year, maybe their second year of college. They were learning that they were not going to actually, in fact, be doctors because they could not handle, they couldn't get good enough grades in the prereqs. So this is like, and not real, I'm serious. I was like half of the dorm was doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that killed my GPA. No shit. Yeah, I know a million people who did that. Because it was such a shit show, eventually I dropped out for 3 years. At the time, I think my GPA was at a 2.3 or something terribly low. Yeah, I get it. I mean, you're like, in this scenario, you're doing your very best, but you're taking real hard college classes and you're just not cutting it. After doing some soul searching and really gaining clarity in life, I went back to school and killed it. I was able to bring my GPA up to a 3.0. You know, I'm so much less interested there in your blended GPA than I am in your GPA after the reboot. Like when you have such a clear reboot in your academic record, I think that's a real good example of where you can write an addendum that just says, I had a reset, you know. I got a 4.0 after the reset.
Yeah. And you don't want to get too much into like explaining like what you did wrong. You just say, hey, I took 3 years off after I came back. I had a 3.96 since September of whatever.
I was pre-med. I took some time off. I got a 4.0 after I came back.
Yep.
That's all you need to say. Okay. I have since pursued a music career as a singer-songwriter. It's been great, but I'm ready for something new. And having several lawyers in my family, I want to be an attorney.
Wait. Sorry. The reason you want to be an attorney is because there are more attorneys in your family or there are other attorneys in your family?
Yeah. Knowing lawyers is not a point against you. Knowing lawyers, knowing what they do, is a point in your favor. Like if you know their real experiences and you want to have that real experience, then okay. Like I buy that. Okay. All caps. I want to go to a top 14. All right. We got that from your subject. Not sure if it helps that I'm a black woman who is 35 plus parentheses. Diversity may work in my favor. ? You want to answer that? Yes or no?
That will help.
Should help for sure. And by the way, everybody's all worried about this Supreme Court decision that's probably going to come out today. I don't think that's going to change no matter what the Supreme Court rules. Even if they say that schools are not explicitly allowed to admit people based on race.
Yeah, they'll shift to socioeconomic or some other factor that is highly affected by race.
Exactly. Yep. They can start looking at what school district you went to, where income, there's lots of things that they can do. But I will tell you that black people are dramatically underrepresented in law school. Law schools want to fix that. So law schools are absolutely going to encourage, they're going to try to get some diversity into their classes. And this is the exact type of thing where a top 14 might make an exception for an exceptional candidate who it's like, yeah, you got bad grades, but you had really good grades after this reset. And most importantly, and Cassandra recognizes this, if I crack 170 on the LSAT, do you think I have a shot in hell? I would say absolutely you have a shot.
You have a shot at getting in. I don't think you have a shot at getting much money, but I think you can get in.
We'll see. We'll see, right? Because that could be the exceptional scholarship candidate. I mean, if you were white, then I think that your scholarship chances here are significantly diminished. But if you're black, there is going to be more competition for your attendance. Like the top 14 are going to be like, we are too fucking white. We need to try to remain diverse. We don't have enough applicants who have stellar grades and stellar LSAT. Here's an applicant who has weak grades, stellar LSAT. How are we going to make the class more diverse?
And the fact that the GPA is better later could be this, she's a diamond in the rough.
Diamond in the rough, right.
Here's, she's going to do well. It just doesn't look like she's going to do well on paper.
Yep. I think you have a shot, Cassandra. I would apply broadly. I think you're wrong to think that you have to go to a top 14. There is nothing magical about the top 14. You know, UCLA may or may not be in the top 14 today. Georgetown may or may not be in the top 14 today. University of Texas in Austin may or may not be in the top 14 today.
Yeah.
But those are all great law schools, and I think you're foolish to rule those out just because they're not in the top 14. Okay, USC is never in the top 14, but I think you're crazy to think that USC is not a school that's going to get you where you want to go.
Yeah.
You know, or I don't know, is there an East Coast, is there a DC school that's like right outside the top 14?
Well, Georgetown, I think you just mentioned that.
Yeah, right? Okay, another school, but Georgetown is sometimes in the top 14. So what's a school that's never in the top 14?
Never in the top 14 would be George Washington. It dropped recently, but it's been 22 in the past, so...
Yeah, knows? And like that's a school that is going to crack open some pretty significant opportunities.
For sure.
You know, so this fetishizing the T14 is really misguided.
Yep.
Okay. Does that mean you can't get a good offer from a T14? Absolutely not. But I would just apply like fairly broadly within the top 30 or so.
Yes.
And maybe even dip down lower in geographical areas where you want to live and work.
Yep. 100%.
Okay. Thanks for writing in, Cassandra. Next one is from Cam. Subject is starting points.
Hey, guys. I've recently signed up for a free account with the LSAT Demon. My question is, should I purely focus on drilling and accuracy first? Once my accuracy increases, should I implement time sections? Or should I implement time sections a few times a week? I currently have the ability to study every day for a minimum of 1 to 2 hours.
Don't care very much. I mean, okay, let me answer the questions in order. Sure. Should I purely focus on drilling and accuracy first? Well, accuracy, yes. You should purely focus on accuracy. Does that mean that you should purely focus on drilling? Or should I start implementing timed sections? I don't see anything wrong with people implementing timed sections right off the bat. I mean, there's a blog post. Again, I mention this all the time. It's a lesson in the Demon. It's called 1 Hour LSAT. If you Google 1 Hour LSAT, you will find it. If you don't find it, Google 1 Hour LSAT Demon, and then you'll definitely find it. This blog post gives you a sample study schedule that I believe works for every student at every point in their LSAT prep. It offers a sample schedule where you would spend 1 hour a day doing a mix of drilling and timed sections. And it's not the be all end all. I'm not saying everybody should follow this religiously. I am saying, though, that if it's your first day of studying, if you wanted to start following that, I would be perfectly happy with it. And I don't care what your level is. It's just like it's a mix of here's some drilling, here's some timed sections. Make sure you take time to review. That's all I really care about.
I agree with that. I would say that if someone is struggling so much that they're struggling to get, say, the first 5 questions right or the first 10 questions right in a section,
maybe
probably
no point
not
doing
necessary.
Timed sections.
Yeah, just, but even then, like do one so you can practice getting better at ignoring the clock, because that's something that people don't do.
How long have you been studying? Yeah. Have you been studying for a month Okay, if you've been studying for a month, then you most definitely should be starting to mix in timed sections. If you don't mix in timed sections, then what are you even doing? You know, it's like you're trying to learn how to play basketball, but you've like never played one-on-one, or you've never played a little like scrimmage, you know?
Scrimmage, yeah, yeah. Get out there. Like, don't just, shoot hoops.
Endlessly shooting free throws or practicing your dribbling or whatever it is. Like, that ain't, you got to play some hoops. So doing these 35-minute sections is playing some hoops. By the way, while you're playing the hoops, focus on making your fucking free throws. Focus on not kicking the ball out of bounds when you're dribbling it. So focus on accuracy while you're doing your timed sections. The point of doing the timed sections is not to make it to the end of the section. The point of doing the timed sections is to learn how to ignore the clock, right? When you drill, you do one question at a time and you focus on getting it right, no matter how long it takes. When you do timed sections, you do one question at a time. You focus on getting them right, no matter how long it takes. Yes, the clock is ticking, but we've turned the clock off as we're doing our timed section. We're practicing ignoring the clock. We're practicing teaching, we're practicing treating our timed sections as if they were untimed drilling. Because that's where you're going to really just get every question right and see how easy the test can be. But don't try to finish.
And this is why I think it's so great to go back and forth, right? Because you can feel what it feels like to do a question without worrying about time when you're doing drilling. And then you got to bring that over to the time section and feel if you're doing things differently or the same, right? If you do all one or all the other.
Is it like, is there an analogy here? Is there anything in weightlifting that helps you have good form?
I don't know, except for doing it. Well, but see, why are we weightlifting? We're weightlifting so that we can be strong and fit elsewhere, right? So if all you ever did was weightlifted, but then you didn't, like, I don't know, go for a run or pick up a box, like, I guess you need life and weightlifting.
I guess I was stretching to try to find some analogy where it's like drilling is kind of where you're on rails a little bit, where it's like, okay, one question, unlimited time, get it right. Like, don't hit submit until you think you've solved it. And by doing drilling, we practice that mindset. When we do timed sections, all we're trying to do is take our practice game to the real game.
Actually, no, I do have an analogy here for weightlifting. Good. And I've noticed this too. When I find my form slipping, I will sometimes go, I will drop the weight or I will go to an extremely low weight
because,
or no weight at all. Sometimes it's like no weight. It's like, what do I want to do with my arms or my legs in this movement? And it's like, how close is that to the, as soon as I start adding weight, because am I trying like shifting to compensate? So yeah.
So the drilling is like is weightlifting with no weights or with low weights. The timed sections are like, okay, here's how this is going to go down on the actual day. Mm-hmm. But I'm striving to just have that same calm form.
Exactly.
One rep at a time, one question at a time. All right. Related ask from another student. I want to be able to do a timed section efficiently to practice. See, efficiently at what that, like, I think what you mean there is like quickly.
Yeah.
But that's not efficient.
Your euphemism. Yeah.
What's efficient is getting it right.
Yeah.
So I don't care about efficiency. I don't care. Like, people can't get their mind wrapped around that, but I just don't care. When you do a timed section, all I care about is your accuracy on your questions completed. I give zero shits how far you made it in that section today.
Yeah.
That's not the point. Like, if I'm watching Ben lift weights and I'm commenting on his form, that'd be fun. I'll be like a sportscaster, bring my microphone and like do reporting on Ben on the bench press.
Yeah. Yep.
And if when I see his form slipping, it's like, okay, I don't give a fuck anymore.
Like, yeah. Well, you don't know what that means.
I don't give a shit.
It's totally true. When I cheat, I don't know how much of a help that cheat is.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So it's
you look like you're doing it. Someone watching you would be like, you know, a novice watching you is like, wow, he's really doing it. And then like your trainer looks at you and goes, what kind of shit is that?
Yeah.
What are you even doing? Go home.
You did 12 reps? Question mark.
Yeah.
Like, you stopped at rep 8. So
Yeah, you did eight real ones and four fake ones. Like, I give no fucks about the fake ones.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Okay, so I want to be able to do a time section efficiently and get a good idea of where I am score-wise. Ideally, how many logic games on the drilled section should I be doing to prepare for the timed tests? And here it's clear that Cam has not yet taken on board this idea that accuracy is the only thing that matters. Cam is saying, how far should I make it through the LG section when I'm doing a timed section? Yeah. And my answer is, as far as you can make it while also getting every question correct. Like, are you getting them right or are you not getting them right? The purpose, I cannot say this clearly enough. Like, you make a fucking ringtone and put it on your phone. The purpose of doing a timed section is to practice ignoring the clock.
Yep. To get comfortable with that, to feel the urge and then say no.
The most important thing you can learn is that it does not matter how far you make it through your timed section. It doesn't matter how many reps Ben completes. It matters how many good reps he completes. Like, it's just, and all that ever matters is one rep at a time, right? Yep. It's not about the next one. It's about this one. Do this one right. And then when you can't do another one right, then you stop. And in this context, it's do the first game right. And if you still have time, then do the second game right. And if you still have time, then do the third game right. But do not, and this came up in an earlier email as well, do not have a goal for how many you're going to do. Don't decide in advance how far you're going to make it through that timed section. Instead, just decide in advance that you're going to solve the first game. Then you're going to solve the second game. However much time you have, you're going to keep solving games until the clock runs out.
100%. By the way, we're going to beat this analogy to death, but I do this too all the time. I will look at what I did before and I said, oh, okay, last time I had this much weight and I did 12 reps. So there's a part of my brain that says, I want to do 12 or more this time. Because if I'm doing, I'll catch myself and I'll say, wait a sec. I only have to do four, or I only have to do one. And then what will happen is when I do that and I'm always just focusing on the next move, and I'm not worried, like, am I going to have enough energy or strength to do all of these? I find myself going to 13, 14, 15, and sometimes way exceeding my expectations.
It's almost like it would be better for you not to have that data with you. It's like, it's almost better for you not to know. It's not relevant, right? Like,
you just have to do. But there is, I mean, to be fair, there is something weird though about
the motivation, and the weightlifting is not timed. So it breaks down completely, right? Because if you were doing it where it was like, okay, I have this much time to do as many good reps as I can.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different exercise than what you're doing. Cause you're just like, I'm going to do reps to exhaustion.
Yep.
And you have unlimited time. So this is the analogy for sure breaks down there. But the thing that is common to them is that you have to stay focused on one rep at a time. Do it with good form. That's all you should be thinking about.
Yep. Yep.
All right.
Exactly.
Let's move along. M has an email here that says, how are non-cumulative GPAs treated by law schools /ABA reports?
Non-cumulative?
I don't know. Go ahead and read it.
Sure. Hi, Ben and Nathan. Do you know how law schools treat NCGPAs, so non-cumulative GPAs, in the admission process? My entire undergrad is pass-fail, so I don't get a numerical GPA from LSAC. Will this increase the weight of my LSAT score has on my chances of being admitted?
Yes.
Yeah, it will, because they can't look to your pass-fail. I mean, they can look to it, but all they see is pass, hopefully. Also, I see in the ABA 509 reports that there is now a row under GPAs, which is labeled number not included in UGPA calculations. Is that number strictly admits without an UGPA? Or are there other ways that schools cannot include a GPA in their calculations?
Ask them. I mean, I think that's going to vary school by school. Didn't we hear recently that there were some schools, I can't remember what that story was, but it was like some school had some weird admissions process where they were like, they would allow you to have the consider one, but not the other or something like that. I mean, who knows what they're doing?
Yeah. And they also have those like early admit programs where they are admitting students from their own, from their undergrad.
Poaching their own undergrads and trying to get them to overpay for the graduate school. Yes.
Although in that case, I guess they're using their GPA, but not their LSAT. But anyways, yeah, there's all sorts of little shenanigans going on here. I imagine that some of those numbers are people who didn't have a GPA. Yeah.
Ask the schools. That's a totally fair question to ask individual schools. You know, might be a kind of a little conversation starter to where you can start to get to know some of these people. Can't hurt you. But yeah, my answer is I do not know. Okay, cool. Next one is from anonymous subject. Question about whether to include ROTC experience in application or not. Hello, Ben and Nathan. I was in ROTC for 2 years of my undergrad, and while I ultimately couldn't commit to my earned scholarship due to medical reasons, I am leaning toward mentioning the ROTC experience somewhere in my application besides my resume. Okay. Is it a feather in, like, is it a highlight of your achievement? Like, is it one of the main things that you are bringing to the school? If not, I don't see how it has really much place in your personal statement, because your personal statement is a page and a half elevator pitch, you know, like, here's why you need me at your school.
Yeah.
I was already told not to include the scholarship I applied to and received through the program, but I have also been told not to mention much about ROTC in my application either. We don't know who is the passive construction here. I was told. You could have
and
said,
we also don't know why.
My right? pre-law advisor told me. Yeah. And then you could have said why, like what was their rationale, not just their conclusion. So all you're telling me is a conclusion from an unnamed
source
expert. Yeah. I disagree, says Anonymous, as ROTC was personally very transformative for me in a personal development way. Besides that, it also explains my STEM major and subsequently my lower GPA. Some branches prefer STEM degrees for scholarship awards. And it is the source of my of one of my letters of recommendation.
I feel
mean
like
that you should put it in your personal statement.
Yeah, I feel like Anonymous is way overthinking this. It's like, yeah, hey, I have a low GPA. I got that because I did STEM. I did STEM because I did ROTC. If you connect all these dots for your reader, they're just going to be like, okay, you got a bad GPA and you're now trying to blame that on ROTC. If you don't connect these dots,
emphasize that in your personal statement.
No,
it's like people are trying to, you know, they're like bringing up their deficiencies in their personal statement.
Yeah. They're worried about them. They can't sleep at night about them. So they're trying to figure out a way to remedy them. The best way to remedy them in a lot of cases is to completely move away from them.
Your personal statement is your Tinder profile. You don't put bad shit about you on your Tinder profile.
The last three people I was with broke up with me quickly.
But it transformed the way that I blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It explains my previous bankruptcy and my 10 children that I have by 8 different women. All that is explained by my, it's like, whoa, okay, they already swiped left an hour ago.
Yeah.
Your personal statement is designed, like, you want it to leave the reader with FOMO, where it's like, I got to have this person in my school.
Yep.
I don't see how you bringing up your transformative whatever that explains your bad GPA. Like, what? You're bringing up shit that is not in your favor. What are you doing? Okay, sorry. Email continues. Is it okay to not model my personal statement around ROTC per se, but have it in somewhere? If not as an addendum, God, thank you in advance. Sorry, I'm not frustrated actually with Anonymous. I'm just marveling at how twisted everybody is about all these different things. I mean, separate. Do not think about your personal statement and your GPA addendum at the same time. GPA addendum, if you're going to write one, is you know, go back to the previous correspondent who was like pre-med, bad GPA, started over, got better grades after that. You might want to write that personal statement. That's a totally separate, or that, sorry, that addendum, but that's a totally separate issue. Your personal statement is your Tinder profile. Like, what is it gonna, what are you gonna show the schools that's gonna get their juices flowing about you? You know, like, yep. Make the school hot for you. How do you do that? Well, you show them all the good things about you.
Yep.
Not the bad things, the good things about you.
They're so nervous about the bad things that they want to explain them.
Protesting like, way too much.
Let it know? Go.
It's like me back when I was a stockbroker a million years ago, like my first job out of college. And I didn't really realize it, but stockbroker, your job is essentially to try to sell people shit.
Yeah.
And I would be like, I wanted the sale, but I also thought that I was like an analyst. And I was like giving them all of the information they needed to make a good decision. And I thought that all this information, once you really think about it, is going to say, yeah, we should do this plan. But I was giving them I'm giving them so many reasons to doubt me that like it was terrible. It's just so confusing. You know, you need to give them a thing that's that just looks like a yes.
Yeah.
Not a maybe, but a yes. So like just show them the good shit about you. It's an elevator pitch. It's a Tinder profile. It's something that they're going to look at real briefly and go, you know, we want this person at our school. Like it's going to suck if they go somewhere else. We want them.
Yep.
Okay. Want to read this one from Mike? Subject is grade point median ?
Hi hosts. Do you think it would be worth mentioning that my grade point median is 0.3 higher than my grade point average?
Nope.
All but one of my classes is in undergrad were 3 credits each, and the exception was a single credit class A. So the math was pretty easy. My UGPA is 3.5, but my UGPA or UGGPM is 3.8 on a 4.0 scale.
No.
What? I never even heard of this thing.
They're GPM? Calculating it themselves. They're like, they're going, well, the weighted average of my GPA is this, but the median grade that I got, like I really actually got more good grades than I got poor grades. It's just that the poor grades were in 4 unit classes and the good grades were in 3 unit classes. And so you see my median GPA is better than my, I mean, I don't know if you can write a 1-2 sentence, like if you want to throw that in there as an addendum, but is this moving the needle, Ben?
I don't think so, because it doesn't matter to them. This number can't be used for anything like rock solid. You also run into the problem of like, I don't know, you're highlighting this class you did more poorly in that ended up bringing.
Maybe, or you're highlighting all the classes that you did a little bit better in. I mean, the anchoring thing, you know, like I feel like this is a thing that might help you 0.5%. If you wrote a 2-sentence addendum and you said my undergraduate GPA doesn't reflect how well I actually performed in these classes. My median GPA was a 3.8, period. Like I don't know that you need to really go into the why that was the case. But if you just say my median GPA was a 3.8, then there is some chance that somebody's going to go, okay, so their UGPA is this, but maybe they're more of a 3.8. And if you had the LSAT that really made that story sing, then they might be going like, oh, look, it's high LSAT and their median GPA is actually 3.8. Maybe we'll give them an exception. But like 99.5% of their brain is going, I don't give a shit. Your UGPA is what shows up on my 509.
Yes. If you do this too, you have to keep it extraordinarily short. It's 1 or 2 sentences. It's just facts. The more you start talking about it, the more annoyed they're going to get.
Yeah, you're wasting their time.
Yeah,
you're grasping at straws.
You're protesting too much, right?
Yep. Or it's like that thing where sometimes one reason is better than 4 reasons.
Often it is. Yeah.
Right?
This is exactly why ads say all the different symptoms that you may suffer, not the most severe one. If they said, oh, you potential side effect,
because
of this
it weakens
death.
It. Right. Yeah. When they go on this litany of 1,000 things that might happen, it's like, well, okay. It's like, because now they're getting to like, well, it might cause,
sneezing and you're like, oh,
to grow
sneezing.
Faster or something like that. You know, and yeah. It's like, yeah, who gives a shit? But the first, or the, probably they buried it in the middle somewhere, cancer. And it's like, the more reasons they give, then the less weight they all have, or we latch on to the weakest one, right? Because we're critical.
Or we also just like average them, right? Like it's like a quick heuristic. It's like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, I realize death is in there, but so is like longer fingernails or whatever the hell you said, or sneezing. And so death is probably rare. It's stupid math because we actually know nothing about the likelihood of death. But if they just said one potential side effect of this medication is death, no one would take it, right? It would be over.
Yeah. And if you, like, there are other good things, Mike. Like, is this a strong enough point that you want people to anchor on it? Because if not, and I don't think it is, they're going to anchor on a weak point instead of a good point. Like, you have whatever it is, like there's your shining LSAT or your 6 years of experience as a paralegal in big law or whatever it is. Like you've got something that makes you a really credible applicant.
Yeah.
But then you bury it in all these other things. It's like putting proficient in Microsoft Word on your resume. Where if I scan your resume and I see proficient in Microsoft Word, I'm like, ah, oh, fuck off. Like what?
Yeah.
Then there could be like really cool stuff at the top of the resume or elsewhere on the resume, but you're burying it in these meaningless details. So I would be careful about this type of shit.
Yeah.
Last one.
Yeah, let's do it.
This was a WAPO opinion piece.
Oh, my stepmom sent this to me. So my parents are really involved in this episode for some reason. But I thought it was an interesting piece because it's just reinforcing what we've already suspected. And that is there's been a long debate ever since student loan programs were initiated by the federal government, whether they help people go to school. And the question is, do they help more people go to college or do they just make it easier for colleges to charge more money because now students have access to more cash that they otherwise wouldn't? And the opinion piece is not definitive by any means, but it simply points out that yet another study has come out that has suggested that the increase in federal loan availability to undergrads and grads, this article is specifically focusing on grad programs, has primarily led to an increase in costs for law school or other grad programs, not to an increase in enrollment. And importantly, it does not seem to help the groups that were intended to be helped, minority groups and so on, did not get the added benefit that many policymakers thought that they would, at least according to this study. There are, of course, people who say, no, the study's not good for this reason or that reason or whatever, but hey, it's one more group of people trying to look at this problem and saying, yeah, loans have just led to higher costs.
Is this a new study? This is an opinion piece from the Washington Post. You have to be really super careful about opinion pieces. They're not like reporting. I mean, you got to be careful enough already with the reporting that you see on the front page. But when you turn to the interior pages and you see these opinion pieces, you got to understand that these are like people grinding axes. And this could easily be someone who has cherry picked all of the studies that show that generous student loan programs do, in fact, make school more expensive. That said, it stands to reason. And my personal opinion is that, of course, generous student loan programs do make school more expensive. How could they not? It's like how insurance, health insurance has made medical care way more expensive, obviously.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of separating the payment from the service. So yeah, the price goes up, no shit. And so, yeah, I think that's almost guaranteed to be true. Food for thought. We'll link to that WAPO article opinion piece in the show notes. Anything else before we wrap it up?
No, that's all.
Awesome. Be LSAT famous. Ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 409 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.